In 3 weeks of wiring and plumbing, of scrapping a good section of the lower hydroponics farm, of finding a pump and routing the overflow to the water treatment facility tanks, and they had uncovered a single step. Solo turned and smiled up at her.
It's working, right?
He scratched his head, his wild hair jutting at all angles, his beard flecked with gray that his youthful jubilance denied. The hopeful question hung in the air, a cloud visible from the cold of the down deep. "It's not working enough," Juliet told him, annoyed with the progress. She peered over the railing, past the jutting toes of borrowed boots, and to the colorful slick of water below. The mirrored surface of oil and gas stood perfectly still. Beneath this coat of slime, the emergency lights of the stairwell glowed eerily green, lending the depths a haunting look that matched the rest of the empty silo. In that silence, Juliet heard a faint gurgle in the pipe beside her. She even thought she could hear the distant buzz of the submerged pump a dozen or so feet below the oil and gas. She tried to will the water up that tube, up 20 levels and hundreds of joints to the vast and empty treatment tanks above. Solo coughed into his fist.
What if we install another?
Juliet raised her hand to quiet him. She was doing the math. The volume of the 8 levels of mechanical was difficult to figure. So many corridors and rooms that may or may not be flooded. But she could guess the height of the cylindrical shaft from Solo's feet to the security station. The lone pump had moved the level of the flood a little less than a foot in 2 weeks. 80 or 90 feet to go. With another pump, say a year to get to the entrance of mechanical. Depending on how watertight the intervening levels were, it could be much more. Mechanical itself could take 3 or 4 times as long to clear.
What about another pump?
Solo insisted. Juliet felt nauseous. Even with 3 more of the small pumps from the hydroponic farms, and with 3 more runs of pipe and wiring to go with them, she was looking at a year, possibly 2, before the silo was perfectly dry. She wasn't sure if she had a year. Just a few weeks of being in that abandoned place, alone with a half-sane man, and she was already starting to hear whispers. To forget where she was leaving things, finding lights on she swore she'd turned off. Either she was going crazy, or Solo found humor in making her feel that way. 2 years of this life, of her home so close but so impossibly far away. She leaned over the railing, feeling like she really might be sick. As she gazed down at the water and through her reflection cast in that film of oil, she suddenly considered risks even crazier than 2 years of near solitude. 2 years, she told Solo. It felt like voicing a death sentence. 2 years. That's how long this'll take if we add 3 more pumps. 6 months at least on the stairwell, but the rest will go slower.
2 years? Solo sung. 2 years! 2 years!
He tapped his boot twice against the water on the step below, sending her reflection into sickening waves of distortion. He spun in place, peering up at her.
Well, that's no time!
Juliet fought to control her frustration. 2 years would feel like forever. And what would they find down there, anyway? What condition would the main generator be in, or the diggers? A machine, submerged under fresh water, might be preserved as long as air didn't get to it, but as soon as any of it was exposed by the pumps, the corrosion would begin. It was the nastiness of oxygen working on wet metal that spelled doom for anything useful down here. Machines and tools would need to be dried immediately and then oiled, and with only 2 of them. Juliet watched, horrified, as Solo bent down, waved away the film of grease at his feet, and scooped up 2 palms of the brackish filth below. He slurped noisily and happily. Okay, with only 1 of them working diligently at salvaging the machines, it wouldn't be enough. Maybe she'd be able to salvage the backup generator. It would require less work and still provide plenty of power.
"What to do for 2 years?"
Solo asked, wiping his beard with the back of his hand and looking up at her. Juliet shook her head. "Oh, we're not waiting 2 years," she told him. The last 3 weeks in Silo 17 had been too much. This she didn't say.
"Okay,"
he said, shrugging. He clomped up the stairwell in his 2 big boots. His gray coveralls were also baggy, like he was still trying to wear clothing tailored for his father. He joined Juliet on the landing, smiled at her through his glistening beard.
"You look like you have more projects," he said, happily.
She nodded silently. Anything the two of them worked on, whether it was fixing the sloppy wiring of the long-ago dead, or improving the farms, or repairing a light fixture's ballast, Solo referred to as a project. And he professed to love projects. She decided it was something from his youth, some sort of survival mechanism he'd concocted over the years that allowed him to tackle whatever needed doing with a smile instead of horror or loneliness. "Oh, we've got quite a project ahead of us," Juliet told him, already dreading the job. She started making a mental list of all the tools and spares they'd need to scrounge on their way back up. Solo laughed and clapped his hands.
"Good," he said. "Back to the workshop."
He twirled his finger over his head, pointing up at the long climb ahead of them. "Not yet," she said. "First, some lunch at the farms. Then we need to stop by supply for more things, and then I need some time alone in the server room." Juliet turned away from the railing and that deep shaft of silver-green water below. "Before we get started in the workshop," she said, "I'd like to make a call."
"A call?" Solo pouted. "Not a call. You spend all your time on that stupid thing."
Juliet ignored him and hit the stairs. She began the long slog up, her 5th in 3 weeks. And she knew Solo was right. She was spending too much time making calls. Too much time with those headphones pulled down over her ears, listening to them beep. She knew it was crazy, that she was going slowly mad in that place. But sitting at the back of that empty server with her microphone close to her lips and the world made quiet by the cups over her ears, just having that wire linking her from a dead world to one that harbored life, it was the closest she could get in Silo 17 to making herself feel sane. 5. Silo 18. Was the year the Civil War consumed the 33 states. More American lives were lost in this conflict than in all the subsequent ones combined, for any death was a death among kin. For 4 years the land was ravaged, smoke clearing over battlefields of ruin to reveal brother heaped upon brother. More than 500,000 lives were lost. Some estimates ranged to almost twice that. Disease, hunger, and heartbreak ruled the life of man. The pages of the book flashed crimson just as Lucas was getting to the descriptions of the battlefields. He stopped reading and glanced up at the overhead lights. Their steady white had been replaced with a throbbing red, which meant someone was in the server room above him. He retrieved the loose silver thread curled up on the knee of his coveralls and laid it carefully into the spine of the book. Closing the old tome, he returned it to its tin case with care, then slid it into the gap on the bookshelf, completing the vast wall of silvery spines. Padding silently across the room, he bent down in front of the computer and shook the mouse to wake the screen. A window popped up with live views of the servers, only distorted from such wide angles. It was another secret in a room overflowing with them, this ability to see distant places. Lucas searched through the cameras, wondering if it was Sammy or another tech coming to make a repair. His grumbling stomach, meanwhile, hoped it was someone bringing him lunch. In camera 4, he finally spotted his visitor. A short figure in gray coveralls, sporting a mustache and glasses. He was slightly stooped, a tray in his hands dancing with silverware, a sloshing glass of water, and a covered plate, all of it partly supported by his protruding belly. Bernard glanced up at the camera as he walked by, his eyes piercing Lucas from a level away, a tight smile curling below his mustache. Lucas left the computer and hurried down the hallway to get the hats for him, his bare feet slapping softly on the cool steel grating. He scrambled up the ladder with practiced ease and slid the worn red locking handle to the side. Just as he lifted the grate, Bernard's shadow threw the ladderway into darkness. The tray came to a clattering rest as Lucas shifted the section of flooring out of the way.
"I'm spoiling you today,"
Bernard said. He sniffed and uncovered the plate. A fog of trapped steam billowed out of the metal hood, two stacks of pork ribs revealing themselves underneath.
"Wow!"
Lucas felt his stomach rumble at the sight of the meat. He lifted himself out of the hatch and sat on the floor, feet dangling down by the ladder. He pulled the tray into his lap and picked up the silverware.
"Wow! I thought we had the silo on strict rations, at least until the resistance was over."
He cut a piece of tender meat free and popped it in his mouth.
"Not that I'm complaining, mind you."
He chewed and savored the rush of proteins, reminded himself to be thankful of the animal's sacrifice.
"The rations haven't been lifted," Bernard said.
He crouched down and waved at the plate.
"We had a pocket of resistance flare up in the bazaar, and this poor guy found himself in the crossfire. I wasn't about to let him go to waste. Most of the meat, of course, went to the wives and husbands of those we've lost."
Lucas swallowed. "How many?"
5, plus the 3 from the first attack.
Lucas shook his head.
"It's not bad, considering."
Bernard brushed his mustache with his hand and watched Lucas eat. Lucas gestured with his fork while he chewed, offering him some, but Bernard waved him away. The older man leaned back on the empty server that housed the uplink and the locking handle for the ladderway. Lucas tried not to react.
"So, how long will I need to stay in here?"
He tried to sound calm, like any answer would do.
"It's been 3 weeks, right?"
He cut off another bite, ignoring the vegetables.
"You think a few more days?"
Bernard rubbed his cheeks and ran his fingers up through his thinning hair.
"I hope, but I don't know. I've left it up to Sims, who's convinced the threat isn't over. Mechanical has themselves barricaded pretty good down there. They've threatened to cut the power, but I don't think they will. I think they finally get that they don't control the juice up here on our levels. They probably tried to cut it before they stormed in, and then were surprised to see us all lit up."
"You don't think they'll cut the power to the farms, do you?"
He was thinking of the rations, his fear of the silo being starved. Bernard frowned.
"Eventually, maybe, if they get desperate enough, but that'll just erode whatever support those greasers have up here. Don't worry, they'll get hungry enough and give in. It's all going by the book."
Lucas nodded and took a sip of water. The pork was the best he thought he'd ever had.
"Speaking of the book," Bernard asked, "are you catching up with your studies?"
"Yeah,"
Lucas lied. He nodded. In truth, he had hardly touched the Book of Order. The more interesting details were found elsewhere.
"Good. When this annoyance is over, we'll schedule you some extra shifts in the server room. You can spend that time shadowing. Once we reschedule the election, and I don't think anyone else will run, especially not after all this, I'll be up top a lot more. IT will be yours to run."
Lucas set down the glass and picked up the cloth napkin. He wiped his mouth and thought about this.
"Well, I hope you're not talking weeks from now. I feel like I've got years of..."
A buzzing noise cut him off. Lucas froze, the napkin falling out of his hand and flopping to the tray. Bernard startled away from the server like it had physically shocked him, or as if its black metallic skin had grown suddenly warm.
"God damn it,"
he said, banging the server with his fist. He fumbled inside his coveralls for his master key. Lucas forced himself to take a bite of food, to act normal. Bernard had grown more and more agitated by the constant ringing of the server. It made him irrational. It was like living with his father again, back before the tub gin finally bore him a hole beneath the potatoes.
"I fucking swear,"
Bernard grumbled, working the series of locks in sequence. He glanced over at Lucas, who slowly chewed a piece of meat, unable suddenly to even taste it.
"I've got a project for you,"
he said, wiggling the last lock free, which Lucas knew could stick a bit.
"I want you to add a panel on the back here, just a simple LED array. Figure out some code so we can see who's calling us. I want to know if it's important, or if we can safely ignore it."
He yanked the back panel off the server and set it noisily against the front of server 40, behind him. Lucas took another sip of water while Bernard peered into the machine's dark and cavernous interior, studying the blinking lights above the little communication jacks. The black guts of the server tower and its frantic buzzing drowned out Bernard's whispered curses. He pulled his head out, which was bright red with anger, and turned to Lucas, who set his cup on his tray.
"In fact, what I want right here is two lights."
Bernard pointed to the side of the tower.
"A red light if it's Silo 17 calling. Green if it's anyone else. You got that?"
Lucas nodded. He looked down at his tray and started cutting a potato in half, thinking suddenly of his father. Bernard turned and grabbed the server's rear panel.
I can prop that back on.
Lucas mumbled this around a hot mouthful of potatoes. He breathed out steam to keep his tongue from burning, swallowed, and chased it with water. Bernard left the panel where it was. He turned and glared angrily into the pit of the machine, which continued to buzz and buzz, the overhead lights winking in alarm.
"Good idea," he said. "Maybe you can knock this project out first thing."
Finally, the server quit its frantic calls, and the room fell silent, save for the clinking of Lucas's fork on his plate. This was like the moments of wry stench quiet from his youth. Soon, just like his father passing out on the kitchen floor or in the bathroom, Bernard would leave. As if on cue, his caster and boss stood, the head of IT again throwing Lucas into darkness as he blocked the overhead lights.
"Enjoy your dinner," he said. "I'll have Peter come by later for the dishes."
Lucas jabbed a row of beans with his fork.
"Seriously? I thought this was lunch."
He popped them into his mouth.
"It's after 8,
Bernard said. He adjusted his coveralls.
"Oh, and I spoke with your mother today."
Lucas set his fork down.
"Yeah?"
"I reminded her that you were doing important work for the silo, but she really wants to see you. I've talked with Sims about allowing her in here."
"Into the server room?"
"Just inside, so she can see that you're okay. I'd set it up elsewhere, but Sims thinks it's a bad idea. He's not sure how strong the allegiance is among the techs. He's still trying to ferret out any source of leaks."
Lucas scoffed.
"Sims is paranoid. None of our techs are going to side with those greasers. They're not going to betray the silo, much less you."
He picked up a bone and picked the remaining meat with his teeth.
"Still, he has me convinced to keep you as safe as possible. I'll let you know if I can set something up so you can see her."
Bernard leaned forward and squeezed Lucas's shoulder.
"Thanks for being patient. I'm glad to have someone under me who understands how important this job is."
"Oh, I understand completely," Lucas said. "Anything for the silo."
"Good."
Another squeeze of his hand, and Bernard stood.
"Keep reading the order, especially the sections on insurrections and uprisings. I want you to learn from this one just in case, God forbid, it ever happens on your watch."
I will, Lucas said. He set down the clean bone and wiped his fingers on the napkin. Bernard turned to go.
Oh.
Bernard stopped and turned back to him.
I know you don't need me to remind you, but under no circumstances are you to answer this server.
He jabbed his finger at the front of the machine. If his hand had been a gun like Peter Billings carried, Lucas could imagine him emptying it into the thing.
I haven't cleared you with the other IT heads yet, so your position could be in, well, grave danger, if you were to speak with any of them before the induction.
Are you kidding? Lucas shook his head. Like I want to talk with anyone who makes you nervous, no frickin' thanks.
Bernard smiled and wiped at his forehead.
You're a good man, Lucas. I'm glad I've got you.
And I'm glad to serve, Lucas said.
He reached for another rib and smiled up at his caster while Bernard beamed down at him. Finally, the older man turned to go, his boots ringing across the steel grates and fading toward that massive door that held Lucas prisoner among the machines and all their secrets. Lucas ate and listened as Bernard's new code was keyed into the lock, a cadence of familiar but unknown beeps, a code Lucas no longer possessed.
For your own good, Bernard had told him.
He chewed a piece of fat as the heavy door clanged shut, the red lights below his feet and down the ladderway blinking off. Lucas dropped the bone onto his plate. He pushed the potatoes aside, fighting the urge to gag at the sight of them. Setting the tray on the grating, he pulled his feet out of the ladderway and moved to the back of the open and quiet server. The headphones slid easily out of their pouch. He pulled them down over his ears, his palms brushing the 3-week growth of beard on his face. Grabbing the cord, he slotted it into the jack labeled 17. There was a series of beeps as the call was placed. He imagined the buzzing on the other side, the flashing lights. Lucas waited, unable to breathe. Hello? The voice sang in his earphones. Lucas smiled. Hey, he said. He sat down, leaned back against server 40, and got more comfortable. How's everything going over there?
6. Silo 18.
Walker waved his arms over his head as he attempted to explain his new theory for how the radio probably worked.
So the sound, these transmissions, they're like ripples in the air, you see?
He chased the invisible voices with his fingers. Above him, the third large antenna he'd built in 2 days hung suspended from the rafters.
These ripples run up and down the wire, up and down.
He gesticulated the length of antenna.
Which is why longer is better. It snags more of them out of the air.
But if these ripples are everywhere, then why aren't we catching any? Walker bobbed his head and wagged his finger in appreciation. It was a good question, a damn good question.
We'll catch 'em this time, he said. We're getting close.
He adjusted the new amplifier he'd built, one much more powerful than the tiny thing in Hank's old hip radio.
Listen,
he said. A crackling hiss filled the room like someone twisting fistfuls of plastic sheeting. I don't hear it.
That's because you aren't being quiet. Listen.
There. It was faint, but a crunch of transmitted noise emerged from the hiss. I heard it! Walker nodded with pride, less from the thing he was building and more for his bright understudy. He glanced at the door, made sure it was still closed. He only spoke with Scotty when it was closed.
What I don't get is why I can't make it clearer.
He scratched his chin.
Unless it's because we're too deep in the earth.
We've always been this deep, Scotty pointed out. That sheriff we met years ago, he was always talking on his radio just fine.
Walker scratched the stubble on his cheek. His little shadow, as usual, had a good point.
Well, there is this one little circuit board I can't figure out. I think it's supposed to clean up the signal. Everything seems to pass through it.
Walker spun around on his stool to face the workbench, which had become dominated by all the green boards and colorful tangles of wires needed for this most singular project. He lowered his magnifier and peered at the board in question. He imagined Scotty leaning in for a closer inspection.
"What's this sticker?"
Scotty pointed to the tiny dot of a white sticker with the number 18 printed on it. Walker was the one who had taught Scotty that it's always okay to admit when you didn't know something. If you couldn't do this, you would never truly know anything.
"I'm not sure,"
he admitted.
"But you see how this little board slotted into the radio with ribbon cables?"
Scotty nodded.
"It's like it was meant to be swapped out. Like maybe it burns up easy. I'm thinking this is the part that's holding us up, like a blown fuse."
"Well, can we bypass it?"
"Bypass it?"
Walker wasn't sure what he meant.
"Go around it, in case it's burned out, short it."
"We might blow something else. I mean, it wouldn't be in here if it weren't truly needed."
Walker thought for a minute. He wanted to add that the same could be said of Scotty, of the boy's calming voice, but then he never was good at telling his shadow how he felt. Only what he knew. "Well, that's what I would try." There was a knock at the door, followed by the squeal of hinges left purposefully loud. Scotty melted into the shadows beneath the workbench, his voice trailing off in the hiss of static from the speakers. "Walk, what the hell's going on here?" He swiveled around on his stool, the lovely voice and harsh words soldered together as only Shirley could fuse them. She came into his workshop with a covered tray, a thin-lipped frown of disappointment on her face. Walker lowered the volume on the static.
"I'm trying to fix the..."
"No, what's this nonsense I hear about you not eating?" She set the tray in front of him and pulled off the cover, releasing the steam off a plate of corn. "Did you eat your breakfast this morning, or did you give it to someone else?"
"That's too much,"
he said, looking down at 3 or 4 rations of food. "Not when you've been giving yours away, it isn't." She slapped a fork into his hand. "Eat. You're about to fall out of your coveralls." Walker stared at the corn. He stirred the food with his fork, but his stomach was cramped beyond hunger. He felt like he'd gone long enough that he'd never be hungry again. The cramp would just tighten and tighten into a little fist, and then he'd be just fine forever. "Eat, damn it." He blew on a bite of the stuff, had no desire to consume it, but put some in his mouth to make Shirley happy. "And I don't want to hear that any of my men are hanging around your door sweet-talking you, okay? You are not to give them your rations, you got that? And take another bite." Walker swallowed. He had to admit the burn of the food felt good going down. He gathered up another small bite.
"I'll be sick if I eat all of this," he said.
"And I'll murder you if you don't." He glanced over at her, expecting to see her smiling, but Shirley didn't smile anymore. Nobody did. "What the hell is that noise?" She turned and surveyed the workshop, hunting for the source of it. Walker set down his fork and adjusted the volume. The knob was soldered onto a series of resistors. The knob itself was called a potentiometer. He had a sudden impulse to explain all of this, anything to keep from eating. He could explain how he figured out the amplifier, how the potentiometer was really just an adjustable resistor, how each little twist of the dial could hone the volume to whatever he... Walker stopped. He picked up his fork and stirred his corn. He could hear Scotty whispering from the shadows. "Oh, that's better," Shirley said, referring to the reduced hiss. "That's a worse sound than the old generator used to make. Hell, if you can turn that down, why ever have it up so loud?" Walker took a bite. While he chewed, he set his fork down and grabbed his soldering iron from its stand. He rummaged in a small parts bin for another scrap potentiometer.
"Hold these,"
he told Shirley around his food. He showed her the wires hanging off the potentiometer and lined them up with the sharp silver prods from his multimeter. "If it means you'll keep eating." She pinched the wires and the prods together between her fingers and thumbs. Walker scooped up another bite, forgetting to blow on it. The corn burned his tongue. He swallowed without chewing, the fire melting its way through his chest. Shirley told him to slow down, to take it easy. He ignored her and twisted the knob of the potentiometer. The needle on his multimeter danced, letting him know the part was good. "Why don't you take a break from this stuff and eat while I'm here to watch?" Shirley slid a stool away from the workbench and plopped down on it.
"Because it's too hot," he said,
waving his hand at his mouth. He grabbed a spool of solder and touched it to the tip of the hot soldering iron, coating it with bright silver.
"I need you to hold the black wire to this."
He lightly touched the iron to the tiny leg of the resistor on the board labeled 18. Shirley leaned over the bench and squinted at the one he was indicating. "And then you'll finish your dinner?"
"Swear."
She narrowed her eyes at him as if to say that she took this promise seriously, then did as he had shown her. Her hands weren't as steady as Scotty's, but he lowered his magnifier and made quick work of the connection. He showed her where the red wire went and tacked that one on as well. Even if none of this worked, he could always remove it and tinker with something else. "Well, now don't let it get cold," Shirley told him. "I know you won't eat it if it cools, and I am not going back to the mess hall to warm it up for you." Walker stared at the little board with the numbered sticker on it. He grudgingly took up the fork and scooped a sizable bite.
"How are things out there?"
he asked, blowing on the corn. "Things are shit," Shirley said. "Jenkins and Harper are arguing over whether or not they should kill the power to the entire silo, but then some of the guys who were there, you know, when Knox and..." She looked away, left the sentence unfinished. Walker nodded and chewed his food. "Some of them say the power in IT was on to the max that morning, even though we had shut it down from here."
"Maybe it was rerouted," Walker said. "Or battery backups. They have those, you know."
He took another bite, but was dying to spin the potentiometer. He was pretty sure the static had changed when he'd made the second connection. "I keep telling them it'll do us more harm than good to screw with the silo like that. It'll just turn the rest of them against us."
"Yeah. Hey, can you adjust this, you know, while I eat?"
He turned the volume up on the static, needing two hands to work the loose knob as it dangled from its bright wires. Shirley seemed to shrink from the noise crackling out of his home-built speakers. She reached for the volume knob as if to turn it down.
"No, I want you to spin the one we just installed."
"What the hell, Walk? Just eat your damn food already." He took another bite, and for all her cussing and protests, Shirley began adjusting the knob.
"Slowly,"
he said around his food. And sure enough, the static from the speakers modulated. It was as if the crunching plastic had begun to move and bounce around the room. "What am I even doing?"
"Helping an old man."
"Yeah, I might need you up here on this one."
Walker dropped his fork and held out his hand for her to stop. She had gone past it, though, into the static once more. Shirley seemed to intuit this. She bit her lip and wiggled the knob the other way around until the voices returned.
"Sounds good. It's quiet down here anyway. You need me to bring my kit?"
"You did it," Shirley whispered to Walker, as if these people could hear her if she spoke too loudly. "You fixed..." Walker held up his hand. The chatter continued.
"Negative. You can leave the kit. Deputy Roberts is already here with hers. She's sweeping for clues as I speak."
"What I'm doing is working while he does nothing,"
a faint voice called out in the background. Walker turned to Shirley while laughter rolled through the radio, more than one person enjoying the joke. It had been a long time since he'd heard anyone laugh, but he wasn't laughing. Walker felt his brows furrow in confusion.
"What's wrong?" Shirley asked. "We did it! We fixed it!"
She got off her stool and turned as if to run and tell Jenkins.
"Wait!"
Walker wiped his beard with his palm and jabbed his fork toward the strewn collection of radio parts. Shirley stood a pace away, looking back at him, smiling.
"Deputy Roberts?"
Walker asked.
"Who in all the levels is that?"
7. Silo 17. Juliet flicked the lights on in the suit lab as she hauled in her latest load from supply. Unlike Solo, she didn't take the constant source of power for granted. Not knowing where it came from made her nervous that it wouldn't last. So while he had the habit, the compulsion even, of turning every light on to full and leaving it there, she tried to conserve the mysterious energy as much as possible. She dropped her recent scavenges on her cot, thinking of Walker as she did so. Is this how he ended up living amongst his work? Was it the obsession, the drive, the need to keep hammering away at a series of never-ending problems until he couldn't sleep more than a few paces from them? The more she understood the old man, the farther away from him she felt, the lonelier. She sat down and rubbed her legs, her thighs and calves tight from the most recent hike up. She may have been gaining her porter legs these last weeks, but they were still sore all the time, the ache in them a constant new sensation. Squeezing the muscles transformed that ache into pain, which she somehow preferred. The sharp and definable sensations were better than the dull and nameless kind. She liked feeling things she could understand. Juliet kicked her boots off, strange to think of these scavenged things as hers, and stood up. That was enough rest. It was as much rest as she could allow herself to have. She carried her canvas sacks to one of the fancy workbenches, everything in the suit lab nicer than what she'd had in mechanical. Even the parts engineered to fail were constructed with a level of chemical and engineering sophistication she could only begin to appreciate now that she understood their evil intent. She had amassed piles of washers and seals, the good from supply and the leftover bad from the lab, to see how the system worked. They sat along the back of her main workbench, a reminder of the diabolical murderousness with which she'd been sent away. She dumped out the parts from supply and thought about how strange it was to have access to live in this forbidden heart of some other silo. It was stranger still to appreciate these workbenches, these immaculate tools, all arranged for the purpose of sending people like her to their death. Looking around at the walls, at the dozen or so cleaning suits hanging from racks in various states of repair, it was like living and working in a room full of ghostly apparitions. If one of these suits jumped down and started moving about on its own, it wouldn't surprise her. The arms and legs on each one were puffy, as if full, the mirrored visors easily concealing curious faces. It was like having company, these hanging forms. They watched her, impassively, while she sorted her finds into two piles. One of items she needed for her next big project, the other of useful tidbits she had snagged with no specific idea of what she might use them for. A valuable, rechargeable battery went in this second group, some blood still on it that she hadn't been able to wipe off. Images flashed through her mind of some of the scenes she'd found while scrounging for materials, like the two men who had committed suicide in the head office of supply, their hands interlocked, opposite wrists slit, a rust-colored stain all around them. This was one of the worst scenes, a memory she couldn't shake. There were other evidences of violence scattered about the silo. The entire place was haunted and marred. She completely understood why Solo limited his rounds to the gardens. She also empathized with his habit of blocking off the server room every night with the filing cabinet, even though he had been alone for years. If someone hadn't long ago fried the electronic keypad that activated the locks on that door, he would probably be employing it to come and go. Juliet didn't blame him. She slid the deadbolts on the suit lab every night before she went to sleep. She didn't really believe in ghosts, but that conviction was being sorely tested by the constant feeling of being watched by, if not actual people, the silo itself. She began her work on the air compressor, and, as always, it felt good to be doing something with her hands.
fixing something, staying distracted. The first few nights, after surviving the horrible ordeal of being sent to clean, of fighting her way inside this carcass of a silo, she had searched, long and hard, for some place that she could actually sleep. It was never going to be below the server room, not with the stench of Solo's debris piles pervading the place. She tried the apartments for IT's head, but thoughts of Bernard made it impossible to even sit still. The couches in various offices weren't long enough. The pad she'd tried to put together on the warm server floor was nice, but the clicking and whirring of all those tall cabinets nearly drove her insane. The suit lab, strangely enough, with the specters and ghouls hanging about, was the only spot where she'd won a decent night of sleep. It was probably the tools everywhere, the welders and wrenches, the walls of drawers full of every socket and driver imaginable. If she was going to fix anything, even herself, it was there in that room. The only other place she'd felt at home in Silo 17 was in the two jail cells she sometimes slept in on trips up and down. There, and sitting behind that empty server, talking to Lucas. She thought about him as she crossed the room to grab the right-sized tap from one of the expansive metal tool chests. She pocketed this and pulled down one of the complete cleaning suits, admiring the heft of the outfit, remembering how bulky it had felt when she'd worn one just like it. She lifted it onto a clear workbench and pulled off the helmet's locking collar, took this to the drill press and carefully bored a starter hole. With the collar in a vise, she began working the tap into the hole, creating new threads for the air hose. She was wrestling with this and thinking about her last conversation with Lucas when the smell of fresh bread preceded Solo into the lab.
"Hello,"
he called from the doorway. Juliet looked up and jerked her chin for him to enter. Turning the tap required effort, the metal handle digging into her palms, sweat forming on her brow.
"I baked more bread."
"Smells great," she grunted.
Ever since she'd taught Solo how to bake flatbread, she couldn't get him to stop. The large tins of flour that had been holding up his canned goods shelves were being removed one at a time while he experimented with recipes. She reminded herself to teach him more things to cook, to put this industriousness of his to good use by having him mix it up a little.
"And I sliced cucumbers,"
he said, proud as if it were a feast beyond compare. In so many ways, Solo was stuck with the mind of a teenager, culinary habits included.
"I'll have some in a bit," she told him.
With effort, she finally got the tap all the way through the pilot hole, creating a threaded connection as neat as if it had come from supply. The tap backed out easily, just like a fitted bolt would. Solo placed the plate of bread and vegetables on the workbench and grabbed a stool.
"What you working on? Another pump?"
He peered at the large wheeled air compressor with the hoses trailing off it.
"No, that was going to take too long. I'm working on a way to breathe underwater."
Solo laughed. He started munching on a piece of bread until he realized she was serious.
"Oh, you're serious?"
"I am. The pumps we really need are in the sump basins at the very bottom of the silo. I just need to get some of this electricity from IT down to them. We'll have the place dry in weeks or months instead of years."
"Breathe underwater?"
he said. He looked at her like she was the one losing her mind.
"It's no different than how I got here from my silo."
She wrapped the male end of the air hose coupler with silicone tape, then began threading it into the collar. "These suits are airtight, which makes them watertight. All I need is a constant supply of air to breathe, and I can work down there as long as I like. Long enough to get the pumps going anyway."
"Wow, you think they'll still work?"
"They should."
She grabbed a wrench and tightened the coupler as hard as she dared. "They're designed to be submerged, and they're simple. They just need power, which we've got plenty of up here."
"Well, what will I do?"
Solo wiped his hands, sprinkling breadcrumbs on her workbench. He reached for another piece. You'll be watching the compressor. I'll show you how to crank it, how to top it with fuel. I'm going to install one of the portable deputy radios in the helmet, here, so we can talk back and forth. There'll be a whole mess of hose and electrical wire to play out. She smiled up at him. Don't worry, I'll keep you busy.
Oh, I'm not worried, Solo said.
He puffed out his chest and crunched on a cucumber, his eyes drifting to the compressor. And Juliet saw, just like a teenager with little practice but great need, that Solo had not yet mastered the art of lying convincingly. 8. Silo 18. Boys from the other side of the camp. These results were closely observed by the experimenters, who were posing as camp counselors. When the violence got out of hand, the experiment was halted before it could run its full course. What began at Robber Cave as two sets of boys, all with nearly identical backgrounds and values, had turned into what became known in the field of psychology as an in-grouping and out-grouping scenario. Small perceived differences, the way one wore a hat, the inflections in speech, turned into unforgivable transgressions. When stones started flying and the raids on each other's camps turned bloody, there was no recourse for the experimenters but to put an end to... Lucas couldn't read anymore. He closed the book and leaned back against the tall shelves. He smelled something foul, brought the spine of the old book to his nose and sniffed. It was him, he finally decided. When was the last time he'd showered? His routine was all out of whack. There were no screaming kids to wake him up in the morning, no evenings hunting for stars, no dimmed stairwell to guide him back to his bed so he could repeat it all the following day. Instead, it was fitful periods of tossing and turning in the hidden bunk room of level 35. A dozen bunks, but him all alone. It was flashing red lights to signal that he had company. Conversations with Bernard and Peter Billings when they brought him food. Long talks with Juliet whenever she called and he was free to answer. Between it all, the books. Books of history out of order. Of billions of people. Of even more stars. Stories of violence, of the madness of crowds, of the staggering timeline of life, of orbited suns that would one day burn out, of weapons that could end it all, of diseases that nearly had. How long could he go on like this, reading and sleeping and eating? The weeks already felt like months. There was no keeping track of the days, no way to remember how long he'd had on this pair of coveralls, if it was time to change out of them and into the pair in the dryer. Sometimes he felt like he changed and washed his clothes 3 times a day. It could easily have been 2x a week. It smelled like longer. He leaned his head back against the tins of books and closed his eyes. The things he was reading couldn't all be true. It made no sense. A world so crowded and strange. When he considered the scale of it all, the idea of this life burrowed beneath the earth, sending people to clean, getting worked up over who stole what from whom, he sometimes felt a sort of mental vertigo, this frightening terror of standing over some abyss, seeing a dark truth far below, but unable to make it out before his senses returned and reality snatched him back from the edge. He wasn't sure how long he sat like that, dreaming of a different time and place, before he realized the throbbing red lights had returned. Lucas returned the book to its tin and struggled to his feet. The computer screen showed Peter Billings at the server door, as deep as he was allowed into the room. A tray with Lucas's dinner sat on top of the work log filing cabinet inside the door. He turned away from the computer, hurried down the corridor, and scrambled up the ladder. After removing the grate, he carefully dropped it back into place and picked a circuitous path through the tall, humming servers.
Here's our little protege.
Peter smiled, but his eyes narrowed at the sight of Lucas. Lucas dipped his chin. Sheriff, he said. He always had this sense that Peter was silently mocking him, looking down on him, even though they were about the same age. Whenever he showed up with Bernard, a especially the day Bernard had explained the need to keep Lucas safe. There had seemed some sort of competitive tension between them. A tension Lucas was aware of, even if he didn't share it. In private, Bernard had committed Lucas to secrecy and told him that he was grooming Peter for the eventual job of mayor, that he and Lucas would one day work hand in hand. Lucas tried to remember this as he slid the tray off the cabinet. Peter watched him, his brow lowered in thought. Lucas turned to go.
"Oh, why don't you sit here and eat?"
Peter asked, not budging from where he leaned against the thick server room door. Lucas froze.
"I see you sitting here with Bernard while you eat, but you're always in a hurry to scurry off when I come by."
Peter leaned out and peered into the stacks of servers.
"What is it you do in here all day, anyway?"
Lucas felt trapped. In truth, he wasn't even all that hungry, had thought about saving it for later, but eating his food to completion was usually the fastest way out of these conversations. He shrugged and sat down on the floor, leaned against the work log cabinet, and stretched his legs out in front of him. Uncovering the tray revealed a bowl of unidentifiable soup, 2 slices of tomato, and a piece of cornbread.
"I work on the servers mostly, just like before."
He started with a bite of the bread, something bland. "Only difference is I don't have to walk home at the end of the day." He smiled at Peter while he chewed the dry bread.
"Well, that's right. You live down in the mids, don't you?"
Peter crossed his arms and seemed to get even more comfortable against the thick door. Lucas leaned to the side and gazed past him down the hallway. Voices could be heard around the corner. He had a sudden impulse to get up and run, just for the sake of running.
"Barely," he answered. "My apartment's practically in the up top."
"All the mids are," Peter laughed, "to those who live there."
Lucas worked on the cornbread to keep his mouth occupied. He eyed the soup warily while he chewed.
"Did Bernard tell you about the big assault we've got planned? I was thinking of going down to take part."
Lucas shook his head. He dipped his spoon into the soup.
"You know that wall mechanical built? How those idiots box themselves in? Well, Sims and his boys are gonna blast it to smithereens. They've had all the time in the world to work on it from our side, so this little rebellion nonsense should be over in a few days, max."
Slurping the hot soup, all Lucas could think about was the men and women of Mechanical trapped behind that wall of steel, and how he knew precisely what they were going through.
"Does that mean I'll be out of here soon?"
He pressed the edge of his spoon into an underripe tomato rather than use the knife and fork.
"There can't be any threat out there for me, can there? Nobody even knows who I am." "Oh, that's up to Bernard. He's been acting strange lately. A lot of stress, I suppose."
Peter slid down the door and rested on his heels. It was nice for Lucas to not have to crane his neck to look up at him.
"He did say something about bringing your mother up for a visit. I took that to mean you might be in here at least a week longer."
"Great." Lucas pushed his food around some more. When the distant server started buzzing, his body practically jerked as if tugged by some string. The overhead lights winked faintly, meaningful to those in the know.
"Well, what's that?"
Peter peered into the server room, rising on his toes a little.
"That means I need to get back to work."
Lucas handed him the tray. "Thanks for bringing this." He turned to go.
"Hey, the mayor said to make sure you ate everything."
Lucas waved over his shoulder. He disappeared around the first tall server and began to jog toward the back of the room, wiping his mouth with his hand, knowing Peter couldn't follow.
"Lucas!"
But he was gone. He hurried toward the far wall, digging his keys out of his collar as he went. While he worked on the locks, he saw the overhead lights stop their flashing. Peter had closed the door. He removed the back panel and dug the headphones out of their pouch, plugged them in.
"Hello?"
He adjusted his microphone, making sure it wasn't too close.
"Hey."
Her voice filled him up in a way mere food couldn't.
"Did I make you run?"
Lucas took a deep breath. He was getting out of shape living in such confinement, not walking to and from work every day.
No, he lied. "But maybe you should go easy with the calling. At least during the day, you know who is in here all the time.
Yesterday, when you let it ring so long, we were sitting right beside the server while it buzzed and buzzed. It really pissed him off.
You think I care if he gets angry?
Juliet laughed.
And I want him to answer. I'd love to talk to him some more. Besides, what would you suggest?
I want to talk to you. I need to talk to someone. And you're always right there. It's not like you can call me and expect me to be here waiting.
Hell, I'm all over the damn place over here. You know how many times I've been from the 30s to supply in the last week? Guess.
I don't want to guess. Lucas rubbed his eyelids.
Probably a half dozen times. And you know, if he's in there all the time, you could just do me a favor and kill him for me. Save me all this trouble.
Kill him? Lucas waved his arm. What, just bludgeon him to death?
Do you really want some pointers? Because I've dreamt up a number of...
No, I don't want pointers. And I don't want to kill anybody. I never did.
Lucas dug his index finger into his temple and rubbed in tiny, forceful circles. These headaches were forever popping up. They had been ever since.
Forget it, Juliet said, the disgust in her voice zipping through the wires at the speed of light.
Look, Lucas readjusted his mic. He hated these conversations. He preferred it when they just talked about nothing. I'm sorry, it's just that... Things are crazy over here. I don't know who's doing what. I'm in this box with all this information. I've got this radio that just blares people fighting all the time, and yet I seem to know rat shit compared to everyone else.
But you know you can trust me, right? That I'm one of the good guys? I didn't do anything wrong to be sent away, Lucas. I need you to know that.
He listened as Juliet took in a deep breath and let it out with a sigh. He imagined her sitting over there, alone in that silo with a crazy man, the mic pressed to her lips, her chest heaving with exasperation, her mind full of all these expectations of him.
Lucas, you do know that I'm on the right side here, don't you? And that you're working for an insane man?
Everything's crazy, he said. Everyone is. I do know this. We were sitting here in IT, hoping nothing bad would happen, and the worst things we could think of came to us.
Juliet released another deep breath, and Lucas thought about what he had told her of the uprising, the things he had omitted.
I know what you say my people did, but do you understand why they came? Do you? Something needed to be done, Luke. It still needs doing.
Lucas shrugged, forgetting she couldn't see him. As often as they chatted, he still wasn't used to conversing with someone like this.
You're in a position to help, she told him.
I didn't ask to be here. He felt himself growing frustrated. Why did their conversations have to drift off to bad places? Why couldn't they go back to talking about the best meals they'd ever had, their favorite books as kids, the likes and annoyances they had in common?
None of us ask to be where we are, she reminded him coolly.
This gave Lucas pause, thinking of where she was, what she'd been through to get there.
What we control, Juliet said, is our actions once fate puts us there.
I probably need to get off.
Lucas took a shallow breath. He didn't want to think of actions and fate. He didn't want to have this conversation.
Pete'll be bringing me my dinner soon, he lied.
There was silence. He could hear her breathing. It was almost like listening to someone think.
Okay, she said. I understand. I need to go test the suit anyway, and, hey, I might be gone a while if this thing works, so if you don't hear from me for a day or so...
Just be careful, Lucas said.
I will. And remember what I said, Luke. What we do going forward defines who we are. You aren't one of them. You don't belong there. Please, don't forget this.
Lucas mumbled his agreement, and Juliet said goodbye, her voice still in his ears as he reached in and unplugged the jack. Rather than slot the headphones into their pouch, he slumped back against the server behind him, wringing the ear pads in his hands, thinking about what he had done, about who he was. He felt like curling up into a ball and crying, just closing his eyes and making the world go away. But he knew, if he closed them, if he allowed himself to sink into darkness, all he would see there is her. That small woman with the gray hair, her body jumping from the impacts of the bullets, Lucas's bullets. He would feel his finger on the trigger, his cheeks wet with salt, the stench of spent powder, the table ringing with the clink of empty brass and with the jubilant and victorious cries of the men and women he had aligned himself with. 9. Silo 18.
Said Thursday that I'd get it to you in 2 days. Well, damn it, it's been 2 days, Carl. You do realize the cleaning's tomorrow morning, right? And you realize that today is still today, don't you? Don't be a smartass. Get me that file and get it up here pronto. I swear, if this shit falls through because you were... I'll bring it. Come on, man. I'm busting your balls. Relax. Relax? Screw you. I'll relax tomorrow. I'm getting off the line. Now don't dick around. I'm coming right now.
Shirley held the sides of her head, her fingers tangled in her hair, elbows digging into Walker's workbench. What in the depths is going on? She asked him. Walk, what is this? Who are these people? Walker peered through his magnifiers. He dipped the single bristle plucked from the cleaning brush into the white paint on the wet lid of primer. With utmost care, his other hand steadying his wrist, he dragged the bristle across the outside of the potentiometer directly opposite the fixed mark he'd painted on the knob itself. Satisfied, he counted the ticks he'd made so far, each one marking the position of another strong signal.
11,
he said. He turned to Shirley, who had been saying something, he wasn't sure what.
And I don't think we've found ours yet.
Ours? Walk, this is freaking me out. Where are these voices coming from? He shrugged.
The city? Over the hills? How should I know?
He started spinning the knob slowly, listening for more chatter.
11 besides us. Ooh, what if there's more? There has to be more, right? What are the chances we've found them all already?
That last one was about a cleaning. Do you think they meant, like... Walker nodded, sending his magnifiers out of whack. He readjusted them, then went back to tuning the dial. So they're in silos? Like us? He pointed to the tiny green board she'd helped him wire the potentiometer to.
It must be what this circuit does. Modulates the wave frequency, maybe.
Shirley was freaking out over the voices. He was more fascinated in these other mysteries. There was a crackle of static. He paused in turning the knob, scrubbed back and forth across it, but found nothing. He moved on. You mean the little board with the number 18 on it? Walker looked at her dumbly. His fingers stopped their searching. He nodded. So there's at least that many, she said, putting it together quicker than he had. I've got to find Jenkins. We've got to tell him about this. Shirley left her stool and headed for the door. Walker bobbed his head. The implications made him dizzy, the bench and walls seeming to slide sideways. The idea of people beyond these walls. A violent roar rattled his teeth and shook the thought loose. His feet slipped out from underneath him as the ground trembled, decades of dust raining down from the tangle of pipes and wires crisscrossing overhead. Walker rolled to his side, coughing, breathing the musky mildew drifting in the air. His ears were ringing from the blast. He patted his head, groping for his magnifiers, when he saw the frame lying on the steel decking before him, the lens broken into gravel-sized shards.
Oh, no! I need...
He tried to get his hands underneath him, felt a twinge in his hip, a powerful ache where bone had smacked steel. He couldn't think. He waved his hand, begging Scotty to come out of the shadows and help him. A heavy boot crunched what remained of his magnifiers. Strong, young hands gripped his coveralls, pulling him to his feet. There was shouting everywhere, the pop and rattle of gunfire.
Walk, you okay?
Jenkins held him by his coveralls. Walker was pretty sure he would collapse if the boy let go.
My Magna...
Sir, we've got to go. They are inside.
Walker turned toward the door, saw Harper helping Shirley to her feet. Her eyes were wide, stunned, a film of gray dust on her shoulders and in her dark hair. She was looking toward Walker, appearing as senseless as he felt.
Get your things, Jenkins said. We're falling back.
He scanned the room, eyes drifting to the workbench.
I fixed it,
Walker said, coughing into his fist.
It works.
A little too late, I think.
Jenkins let go of his coveralls, and Walker had to catch himself on his stool to not go tumbling back to the ground. The gunfire outside drew nearer. Boots thundered by, more shouting, another loud blast that could be felt through the floor. Jenkins and Harper were at the doorway shouting orders and waving their arms at the people running past. Shirley joined Walker at his workbench. Her eyes were on the radio.
Oh, we need this, she said, breathing hard.
Walker looked down at the glittering jewels on the floor. 2 months' wages for those magnifiers.
Walk! What do I grab? Help me!
He turned to find Shirley gathering up the radio parts, the wires between the boards folded up, tangled. There was a single loud pop from one of the good guns right outside his door, causing him to cower, his mind to wander.
Walk!
The antenna,
he whispered, pointing to where the dust was still drifting from the rafters. Shirley nodded and jumped up on his workbench. Walker looked around the room, a room he promised himself he would never leave again, a promise he really had meant to keep this time. What to grab? Stupid mementos? Junk? Dirty clothes? A pile of schematics? He grabbed his parts bin and dumped it out on the floor. The radio components were swept in, the transformer unplugged from its outlet and added. Shirley was yanking down the antenna, the wires and metal rods bundled against her chest. He snatched his soldering iron, a few tools. Harper yelled that it was now or never. Shirley grabbed Walker by the arm and pulled him along toward the door. And Walker realized it was going to be never. 10. Silo 17. The panic she felt from donning the suit was unexpected. Juliet had anticipated some degree of fear from slipping into the water, but it was the simple act of putting on the cleaning suit that filled her with a hollow dread, that gave her a cold and empty ache in the pit of her stomach. She fought to control her breathing while Solo zipped up the back and pressed the layers of Velcro into place.
"Where's my knife?"
she asked him, patting the pockets on the front and searching among her tools.
"It's over here," he said.
He bent down and fished it out of her gear bag, out from under a towel and change of clothes. He passed her the knife, handle first, and Juliet slotted it into the thick pocket she'd added on the suit's belly. It was easier to breathe, just having it within reach. This tool from the upper cafe was like a security blanket of sorts. She found herself checking for it the way she used to check her wrist for that old watch.
"Let's wait on the helmet," she told Solo as he lifted the clear dome from the landing. "Grab that rope first."
She pointed with her puffy mitts. The thick material and the two layers of undersuit were making her warm. She hoped that boded well for not freezing to death in the deep water. Solo lifted the coils of spliced rope. A large, adjustable wrench the length of his forearm knotted at the end.
"Which side?"
he asked. She pointed to where the gracefully curving steps plunged into the green-lit water.
"Lower it over steady, and hold it out so it doesn't get caught on the steps below."
He nodded. Juliet checked her tools while he dropped the wrench into the water, the weight of the hunk of metal tugging the rope straight down to the very bottom of the great stairwell. In one pocket, she had a range of drivers. Each one was tied off with a few feet of string. She had a spanner in another pocket, cutters behind pocket number 4. Looking down at herself, more memories flooded back from her walk outside. She could hear the sound of fine grit pelting her helmet, could sense her air supply running thin, could feel the clomp of her heavy boots on the packed earth. She gripped the railing ahead of her and tried to think of something else, anything else. Wire for power and hose for air. Concentrate. She would need a lot of both. She took a deep breath and checked the tall coils of tubing and electrical wire laid out on the deck. She had flaked them in figure 8 so they would be impossible to tangle. Good. The compressor was ready. All Solo had to do was make sure everything fed down to her, didn't get caught up.
"It's on the bottom," Solo said.
She watched him knot the line to the stairway railing. He was in good spirits today, lucid and energetic. This would be a good time to get it over with. Shifting the flood to the treatment plant would have been an inelegant temporary solution. It was time to get those big pumps down below churning through that water properly, pumping it through the concrete walls and back into the earth beyond. Juliet shuffled to the edge of the landing and looked down at the silvery surface of the foul water. Was this plan of hers crazy? Shouldn't she be afraid? Or was it the years of waiting and doing this safely that was more terrifying to her? The prospect of going mad, inch by inch,